Robert Stark. I am joined here with Professor Paul Gottfried. It's nice having you on the show.
It's nice being on your show.
So what we're going to be discussing is your speech on cultural Marxism, and you gave this speech recently. It's at the Identitarian Ideas Conference in Sweden.
Yes.
Before we get to the speech, what was your overall take on the conference and also your experience in the country of Sweden?
Well, I actually enjoyed the conference. I thought all of the speeches were worth listening to. There were a few of them in Swedish. I can understand a little Swedish because I know German very well and Dutch and a few other languages, but I could sort of follow the gist of those speeches. The other ones that were given in English were a bit easier to follow. But I was very impressed by the crowd of young people that they drew. I finally got to meet Manuel Ochsenreiter from Germany, who is the editor of Zur Zeit, which I think I may even have written for at some point in the past. And then I met a young gentleman named Vaudron, who was the head of the movement Identitaire in where he lived, which was Nice in southern France. There was somebody from Geneva who was there. Most of the Swedish conferees and participants were extremely intelligent, and all of them spoke flawless English, which impressed me. I liked what I saw of Sweden. I saw mostly Stockholm. I went with my daughter, youngest daughter came with me, and I was impressed by all the things which the present government is unimpressed by. I was impressed by the castles. I was impressed by the statues of great kings. I was impressed by the tomb of Gustavus Adolphus, who was probably my favorite ruler. I saw the grave of Gustav II, Gustav III, Charles XII. All of this recalled my studies as a graduate student in history at Yale many years ago. I visited Uppsala. I saw the university. But I was a bit disappointed that most of the buildings in what I thought was a very old university looked relatively modern. Indeed, some of them were constructed in the last 40, 50 years. What I liked most in Uppsala was actually the mounds on the outskirts of the city, which were burial sites for the Vikings. And these were very, very high mounds, which towered over the green plains, which are characteristic of the Swedish countryside. And we also visited the home of Linnaeus, the famous biologist, which was probably about 4 or 5 miles outside of Uppsala. Considering how little time I spent there, we probably saw a great deal of the country. Somebody asked me if I deplore the leftist politics of Sweden. The only thing that I deplored on my visit was the cost of living. My brother, who's visited Sweden several times, said he plans to write a book, Visiting Sweden on $3,000 a day. It's a very expensive country, and I suspect that the prices are so high there and in Denmark and in Norway, all the Scandinavian countries, not but Finland, but the other ones, all have high prices. And I think this may be at least partly caused by the socialist economy and the fact that so much money has to be given back to the government in order to pay for all the social programs.
So your speech at the conference was about cultural Marxism.
Right.
On the topic itself, where does this all begin? What's the original founders of cultural Marxism? I mean, who were they, and what led them to start that movement?
There's a very, very long, densely written study in German by a man named Rolf Wiegensbach called Die Frankfurter Schule, the Frankfurt School, which deals with the origins and the periodic reappearance of the Frankfurt School. It actually goes back to the 1920s. The father of Max Horkheimer paid for the original premises, the original buildings on which they met, and it attracted what were really sort of oddball Marxists. They were not orthodox Marxists, since if you read their works, it's clear that they're not socioeconomic determinists. Their notion of a workers' revolution is somewhat vague. And although they hate the bourgeoisie, it is not because of the contradictions of capitalism so much as because of what they see as the bigotry and repression characteristic of a bourgeois society. So what drives their socialism, to whatever extent it can be described as socialist, is a cultural critique of the bourgeoisie and of Christianity. Not surprisingly, the majority of its members were Jewish. They probably suffered from the sense of marginality or alienation, which has been characteristic of many Jewish intellectuals in the modern world. Curiously enough, the most important name in the school, which is Theodor Adorno, was only half Jewish and was raised as a Roman Catholic by his Catholic mother. Nonetheless, I think in Adorno, you can one can find many of this, what you would say, this the signs of Jewish alienation that some people have seen, I think, properly seen in the Frankfurt School. And it is interesting that somebody like Kevin MacDonald, who is clearly no fan of the Jews, and Zoltán Tár, who was in fact a Jewish Hungarian Jewish Marxist, both seem to arrive at the same view of the Frankfurt School as sort of being driven by a sense of Jewish marginality, insecurity, Jewish intellectuals who look upon themselves as being marginal, German Randständig, in what is a predominantly Christian bourgeois society. By the way, all of them came from unmistakably bourgeois backgrounds. They all came from wealthy bourgeois backgrounds, but the sense of alienation is very clearly there. What I did try to show in my speech, or rather a point that I tried to stress, is it would be simplistic to try to reduce all their thinking to their Jewish background or Jewish sense of Jewish marginality, because the ideas that they expound take on a life of their own. And they are appealing to large numbers of people living in predominantly Christian countries. And if one looks at the Western world, just about anywhere in the Western world today, the dominant political culture is cultural Marxism. It is unmistakably there. Although, as I point out in my speech, it is there in a much more exaggerated form than one would have found in most of the early members of the Frankfurt School. The first generation sort of suffer the fate of exile when the Nazis take over Germany. They land up in Columbia University. They create a special department for them. And then after the war, starting in 1950, they go back to Germany, and the University of Frankfurt, where Horkheimer is able to reestablish himself, becomes sort of the bastion of the Frankfurt School, what we call cultural Marxism, or what they call critical theory in the post-war years. There's a second generation of thinkers, which is perhaps best represented by Jürgen Habermas in Germany, which sort of move off in their own direction. They become violently anti-German, anti-national. They talk about rooting out any sense of national consciousness among the Germans, except to the extent that they should beat their breasts perpetually for starting World War I, World War II, the Franco-Prussian War, and probably beating up on the Romans under Arminius. They are hysterically anti-German, the second generation of the Frankfurt School, and they see themselves as leading the anti-fascist movement. Now, as I try to indicate, these positions were not particularly characteristic of the older generation. The older generation was not particularly anti-German. They were anti-fascist, obviously.
You're talking about the original Marxists in Germany.
Right, the original cultural Marxists, we call, or the framers of what's called critical theory, which is the position of the Frankfurt School, their critical perspective on bourgeois society. The original architects of this position were not anti-German. This is going to become characteristic of the second generation. Another point that I try to make is that I was a student of Herbert Marcuse, who is one of the perhaps two or three most famous names in the first generation of the Frankfurt School. And he never showed that much interest in feminism. I don't think his view of gay rights would have been any different from mine at the time. But it's very clear that both feminism and gay rights, you know, have some roots in Frankfurt School critical theory, and one could find a critique of homophobia and anti-feminism, certainly in the authoritarian personality.
Yeah, I mean, even today, I mean, in Eastern Europe and South America, there's plenty of Marxists who totally reject all those cultural Marxist values.
That is correct. In fact, when I told some friend of mine who was also interested in critical theory that I think the communists were right in treating the cultural Marxists as heretics, he said, "You and Stalin would agree on that." And my answer is yes, Stalin and I would agree on that. They are not real Marxist or Marxist-Leninist.
Was Trotsky influenced by them?
No. Trotsky would have rejected them as readily as Stalin. It would have been no difference on that point. Trotsky saw himself as an orthodox Marxist-Leninist. He was he was Lenin's leading disciple. The disagreement between him and Stalin is it's personal. Stalin wants power; he takes it from Trotsky. Trotsky believes in international revolution. Whereas, although Stalin doesn't reject international revolution, he stresses the importance of creating a perfect socialist society in the Soviet Union before trying to communize the rest of the world. So there is this difference between them, but on the question of cultural Marxism, there would have been absolutely no disagreement, whatever.
And yet. The other thing is you talk about how the cultural Marxists are heretics to economic Marxism, and you even see the trend. I mean, cultural Marxists are willing to work with big multinational corporations.
Right, right. Yeah, because they're not primarily concerned with social, with economic questions. What they're concerned with is radicalization of a bourgeois Christian culture. I make these points in great detail in my book on The Strange Death of European Marxism, which came out about 7 years ago. I probably have made the same arguments in other works since then. I think there's an enormous gulf between the cultural Marxist and real Marxist. One of the evidences of this difference is that traditional Marxists are usually social-cultural conservatives. They throw homosexuals into concentration camps. They don't really buy feminism, except to the extent that they can use women, to increase production or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, feminism is fairly weak in former communist countries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, the corporations were the ones who actually promoted it because they wanted to double the size of the workforce and consumer base.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would agree. It's multinational corporations and what I call the therapeutic managerial state in the West, of which both the Republicans and Democrats are quintessential expressions. Obama is not fighting a war against capitalism. He's fighting a war against Christianity, heterosexual marriage. I think he lives quite happily with Goldman Sachs. They're not a problem. He may occasionally denounce them, this is mostly for show. I mean, those are people who heavily financed his campaign. And his opponent, Mitt Romney, did not express any social differences from Obama. I remember that second debate the two of them had. You couldn't tell one from the other. And I think Mitt Romney, as a representative of multinational corporations, probably sees the social views of Obama as very helpful. Feminism is helpful. He went out of his way, Romney, to show how he had supported the feminist movement. I don't think they would differ on that. I don't think they would differ on gay rights. Although I think in the case of Obama, his background is more of a cultural Marxist one than Romney's Mormon background. Although I would agree with you that because of Romney's representation of corporate capitalism, feminism, or gay rights, all these other things are probably seen as useful positions.
And I mean, the other thing is a lot of the upper class cultural Marxists.
Sure.
You have the upper class cultural Marxists in this country, and I'm sure in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll give lip service to economic leftism, but at the same time they don't take it seriously because it's not in their own self interest, and they don't want to sacrifice their own wealth.
That's correct. I also, as I tell people who rage against capitalists, they really do not. I mean, Marx had too much respect for capitalists. He thought they actually created the superstructure of ideas. Maybe they did in the early 19th century, the mid-19th century. My experience is they simply take over whatever's there. You know, they just drink from the same cesspool as everyone else, and they just run with those ideas. Their major concern is simply surviving. And the second concern is prospering. And certain sets of ideas are more useful than others. I mean, I'm sure they don't like the government coming in and suing them for sexism or homophobia, but then you know they don't mind having affirmative action guidelines that can be used to remove, should we say, less well organized or less wealthy competitors. They're also quite happy to push internationalism, whatever comes along, feminism, putting women in the workplace, breaking down national borders, all the rest of this. These are all experiential positions for capitalists. In these situations, they're not simply trying to get along, they're actually trying to promote their interests.
And I mean, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Kerry Bolden's work, but he's actually documented how much that the left has actually sold out to the big capitalist.
You know, I have no problem with that. I have a young friend, David Farbeaton, in Toronto, who's actually doing a book on this. And you know, as I tell him, I think the only thing we disagree about is that he assigns too much social significance to capitalists. I just see them as whores. You know, just go along with whoever's in power. But at the same time, they do have certain interests in breaking down gender barriers, national barriers to further their interest. And the fact that so many of them gave money to Obama, I think, is significant. If you read the Wall Street Journal, I'm trying to figure out what is it that supposedly makes the newspaper conservative, except for the fact that it supports corporate capitalism. And wars to expand democracy, which I think is simply liberal internationalism on steroids, I'm not sure that's a conservative position.
I mean, that's basically what the mainstream conservative movement is all about tax cuts for the rich, deregulation
mm-hmm.
of Wall Street,
right.
wars
mm-hmm.
in the Middle East. Plus, on top of that, they have adopted aspects of cultural Marxism.
Well, I agree they've adopted cultural Marxism, but I think that not everything that these people favor is done for corporate capitalism. I think the support for wars in the Middle East is being done because the neoconservatives pay for all of this. You know, I mean, and the neoconservatives are fanatical Zionists, so they have to give them wars in the Middle East. They also have to deal with the religious right. The religious right they can manipulate. You know, I know people who are in the religious right, and, you know, if you say, gee whiz, we really don't like gay marriage, but, you know, we're not going to be able to fight it, and we've lost every few weeks, I remember for a while, the Wall Street Journal, usually through Irving Kristol, would announce, we've lost the cultural wars. The following week, they would announce the conservative cause has won. Well, what they were saying is, the conservative cause wins, but it just drops the cultural wars. They were never very interested in those in the first place. But I think that they have to pretend to be interested in traditional marriage or something like that in order to hold on. Or but right now, some of them are coming out against it. They're divided on immigration. The conservative wing of the Republican Party does oppose immigration. The Wall Street Journal is enthusiastically behind this. You know, they just open up the borders. They'd flood the country with Latinos if they could, even though it means that the Republican Party, to which they have worked primarily, would be doomed. You know, once you've got like 50 million more Latinos, it's all over. But, you know, I think the Wall Street Journal is able to appeal to corporate interests by saying that, you know, this will drive down the cost of labor even more.
So I think with the conservatives, they're not so much consciously aware of cultural Marxism. But I'll give you one example with the neoconservatives, at least. If you oppose their foreign policy, you're automatically anti-Semitic. That's sort of a cultural Marxist tactic, is everything everything that goes against their agenda is racism or homophobic or misogynist or anti-Semitic.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to understand that the neoconservatives know the political culture is entirely cultural Marxist. So, you know, if they want to kick somebody out, they kicked me out of the conservative movement, like back in the 1980s. I couldn't write for them anymore and so forth. And at first, there was nothing they could have attacked me for except that I was crazy or something like this. I think this is the charge David Froom raised against me in 2003 in his article on the unpatriotic right. But the other people, they would say, well, they're really anti-Semitic or they're Catholic anti-Semites.
Like with Pat Buchanan.
Right, Pat Buchanan. Or they really hate blacks, you know, or they don't believe, they're racist because they don't believe the entire world could have a government as good as the administration of New York City or something like, you know, something like American democracy in its present form is actually applicable to the entire world. And if people deny that, they obviously are racist. I mean, or cultural relativists. This is what you get from some of the Straussians in my view. They're cultural relativists because they don't believe that our absolute values, because we've made them absolute, therefore absolute, should apply to everyone in the world.
And a lot of their ideas, I mean, they despise Christianity, but it is a lot like, it's sort of like the Catholic Church, where they try to make certain ideas as being like sinful, and they come up with sort of like a devil-like figures.
Well, I really don't think it's the Catholic Church. I think it's communism. Communism takes over the structure and the dogmatic authority of the Catholic Church, or sort of imitates this. And the neoconservatives are simply the communists are very appealing to the post-war conservative movement. Frank Meyer, who had been a communist, continues to admire the way the communist cadres were organized. He writes about this in the 1960s. Communism was a very appealing movement in many ways because it showed, you know, how the right would have to organize itself. In the case of the neoconservatives, I think the association with communism is a bit more direct in the sense that they really are a movement of the left. And, you know, at least the older generation do come out of the radical left. And if you remember, the radical left also had sectarian wars, right? And every sect, including the Communist Party, which was the larger sect, would condemn the deviationist as being something or other. You know, you were wicked people. They couldn't say you're going to hell because there was no heaven or hell. But
when that group Femin they went to the Notre Dame Cathedral when Dominique Venner commits suicide, and they have a sign saying a fascist rot in hell.
Who did this?
You know, Femin. They're the radical feminist group in Europe.
Yeah, but I mean, these aren't neocons. I mean, they're a group that. But by the way, I was really struck by the fact that the neocons went after Putin because he arrested those women who desecrated the altar in a Russian Orthodox. Yeah. I mean, they really got behind them, and they've been. He was perfectly right. They've also been beating up on the Russians and Serbs for not allowing gay pride parades. This is apparently now an integral part of neocon, the neocon concept of American democracy.
Well, it's the same. It's the same way they attack Islam from the left. Like they say, like if you look at Muslim immigration into Europe, they don't say Muslim immigration to Europe is bad because it's displacing Europeans.
No,
they
say it's bad to homosexuals.
Yeah, it's homophobic or it's anti-feminist.
Right, right. Yeah, of course. I mean, but remember, everyone around them is on the left. you cannot make conservative art. They're not going to be very useful. I think part of this is strategy. If the people you're appealing to are all cultural Marxists, so they just adopt that vocabulary. I do agree, however, with your other point that many of the neoconservatives, sort of, especially the second generation, like Jonah Goldberg, John Podoretz, they all seem to be buying into the cultural Marxist values, you know, that we're not really free or free of prejudice unless we have gay marriage, and we applaud the feminist movement, which was great up until Obama became president because he's not good for Israel or something like that. What you get is simply a gradual buying into everything the left has done, you know, up until 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And this, I think, is characteristic of the second generation of neoconservatives.
And I guess what you can talk about, what are some of the experiences you've had with cultural Marxism in universities?
Well, these people would never call themselves cultural Marxists. They probably wouldn't even know a cultural Marxist. So, you know, they wouldn't even know what it is. Although I have had some academics asking me, you know, what they should read because they're really interested in the Frankfurt School. One of the arguments that I made in my talk in Sweden is that most academics in America are not cultural Marxists because they're far more radical than the cultural Marxists. You know, I think of Marcuse, then I think of John Podoretz. Marcuse was much more conservative in his social cultural values. It's just that our entire culture has become so radicalized. And it's even worse in other countries. I mean, it's worse in Europe. A German friend told me that in Ecuador, somebody was removed from consideration for president because he said something critical about homosexual marriage. This is Ecuador. I mean, the question is, why have these ideas spread like this? I mean, Marxism, I can understand. There's some rational core in Marxism.
I think the key difference is cultural Marxism economically is a bourgeois movement.
Mm-hmm.
Cultural Marxism is economic Marxism. At least they did start off with the support of a lot of the poor and the working class.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true. There is a social class that supports it. The only class that seems to support this sort of cultural Marxism on steroids is the class is the managerial class, the people who work in corporate capitalism, corporate finance, and most of all in government, and the educational establishment, right?
And the media.
And the media, right, they're all the same. I think as the late Sam Francis would point out, these are isomorphic and intersecting structures. Right, and they pretty much have taken over all Western societies.
So technically, see, a true Marxist is anti-bourgeoisie. A cultural Marxist is not anti-bourgeoisie. They just think that the old bourgeoisie needs to be replaced by a new bourgeoisie.
Who would hold that position? The cultural Marxists would like to destroy anything bourgeois. They hate the bourgeoisie.
They hate the old bourgeoisie, but they're the new bourgeoisie.
No, they're not really a bourgeoisie. I think what they want are people with money, you know, and leftist social values who will be running society for the rest of us. This is my disagreement with somebody like Charles Murray, who talks about the cognitive elite and how good they are, and they represent bourgeois values. They don't. The old bourgeoisie had very, very conservative values. It also had a deep race consciousness, a gender consciousness. I mean, you know, if you study European history, it's obvious that the bourgeoisie is a profound, once it takes, it's profoundly reactionary. And, you know, the bourgeoisie joins in fascist movements in the interwar years. The bourgeoisie supports the nationalist side in the Spanish Civil War. I think there is a money-making class that we're dealing with today. People work in a kind of corporate capitalist structure, but they're not really part of the traditional bourgeoisie. They're part of the managerial class.
So you're saying there has to be a distinction. The bourgeoisie, it's used in different terms. Sometimes it's used to describe. I mean, a lot. It is popular to use that term to describe sort of the upper class, but you would make a distinction between the middle class as a bourgeoisie as opposed to the plutocracy.
That's correct. I mean, the bourgeoisie were the plutocracy in the past. They've been replaced by a managerial class. I agree with James Burnham, with Sam Francis. My book, After Liberalism, is a discussion of that displacement that takes place by the early 20th century. And continues throughout the 20th century, that the bourgeoisie is going to be displaced, supplanted, and what we see today is not the bourgeoisie. We have a managerial plutocracy that buys into all the values of the cultural left. The older bourgeoisie was very much in favor of nation states, strong gender relations. Had a deep racial consciousness, and was, you know, run by men, you know, threw homosexuals into jail.
So you say that the concept of racism has its origins in cultural Marxism,
or the condemnation of racism? Yes. Now, it is possible, I suppose, to be critical of racism and not be a cultural Marxist. But as soon as I hear someone, you know, attacking racism, I immediately think of cultural Marxism. I mean, there is an inevitable association that I make between the two. Certainly, anti-racism is a cultural Marxist position.
Or they call themselves either the anti-racist movement or the anti-fascist movement.
Anti-fascist. I have a book I wrote for Cambridge. It's not out yet, but it's on fascism and anti-fascism, showing that anti-fascism is a much greater problem than fascism. And there's like no way of solving this problem that I can see. It's possible for me to say that. You know, we should all be, all races should be nice to each other or something like that, and we should not treat a person badly because of racial difference, fine. But if I describe myself as an anti-racist, I would argue that's an ideological position, which is closely identified with cultural Marxism.
Like, for instance, you like they'll say just calling for any kind of limitations on immigration is racist or fascist.
Yes, that's right. But I think here we have to understand the change in the nature of democracy. That is, my book After Liberalism, which Princeton published in 1999, goes into this. That originally democracy was simply, you know, the way a particular people ruled itself. It was popular a particular self-identified people, the way its citizens govern themselves is democracy. Starting in the interwar period, maybe earlier, you get a notion that democracy must be pluralistic, that you must bring all kinds of people into the mix. Okay, why? I don't know. You didn't say the United States just thinks worked out this way, but no, it becomes an ideology of pluralism, which eventually will become, you know, sort of merge with cultural Marxism. So you see that everybody has to all true democracies are pluralistic. Now, you know, I mean, Poland has a democracy today. It's not pluralistic. It's full of Poles. The Jews have a democracy in the Middle East, and it's a specifically Jewish state, right? I mean, look at them. You know, these democracies look like they're nationals. They're just the way particular nations
think. And our politicians will openly say that about Israel. I think Bill or Hillary Clinton said that. And Obama, Bush, they've all said that about Israel.
Now, what they say?
They've endorsed it as an ethno-state.
Well, I mean, you know, I can endorse them, but they are not like the administration of New York City or like, you know, American pluralistic democracy. They are, in fact, a nation state with an ethnic base. They were set up to be an ethnic state. I find nothing wrong with that. Just, you know, you don't misrepresent people. But I think even the democratic pluralism went beyond being democratic pluralism. And already in the struggle against fascism, you have the attempt to the successful attempt to argue that one can only be a Democrat if one holds certain attitudes which social engineers and so-called educators will provide us with. Now, if I were to say I'm against further immigration into the country, that is an undemocratic attitude. Now, you're going to say, well, why is it undemocratic? Right? You're going to ask, because after all, you know, the people, the citizens, no. Those citizens are acting undemocratically. I see in the case of Belgium that the Vlaams Bloc, you know, faces problems because they want a Flanders for Fleming. No, that is undemocratic. One must be part of a universal political entity in which everybody should be allowed to come in and to express themselves and so forth. Now, I would argue this goes beyond cultural Marxism. This is some form of group insanity that I can't really understand.
You're saying the original cultural Marxists sounded pretty reasonable in comparison.
In comparison to what we have now, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. This has gone well beyond that. And the notion of democracy is so expansive, it has become utterly meaningless. It means whatever political elites want to do to us is democratic, or the journalists. The same with you. What is a human right? It is something that journalists and intellectuals decide they like, and they want the rest of us to accept. That becomes a human right. Now, if you want to talk about rights, I understand that as an historical concept. There are historical rights. You know, that the Englishmen, as Burke says, have historical liberties, which they like. For instance, the right to bear arms is an historical liberty of Englishmen. He does not claim that this is somehow inherent in the universe. I'm reading these American libertarian and religious right websites, and they say the right to bear arms is a human right. How is it a human right? But what we're being told is it's something that the writer of that website, the person writing on the website, believes in or likes. Therefore, it must be a human right. Now, if you want to say it's in the Constitution, it is in the Constitution. It is the Second Amendment, and it is in British common law. It was taken over from the common law. That's fine. And it's part of the tradition of British people or whatever, people who take over the common law and the British political tradition. I have no problem with it. Don't tell me it is a human right. It is not a human right. It's a specific historical right that develops in that exists in particular cultures. I think the best thing we can do is simply to particularize everything. Historicize, particularize. I get absolutely sick when I hear about human rights, universal democracy means the right of everybody to come in here, and you do not have a right to be against immigration. It's an undemocratic. I have absolutely no understanding of how you can say it is undemocratic for citizens of a country to say they're against immigration.
And when did that specific trend really start?
I think that has really started in the post-war years among liberals who began talking about, Jews were not allowed to come to America because, there were nasty Protestant anti-Semites keeping them out or something like that. And then the sort of like mushrooms afterwards, certainly after the 60s, where things...
Or they'll blame the Holocaust on American immigration policy.
Yes, which is utterly ridiculous. The reality is that many more people could have got out than got out. Many just decided to stay. Many were totally unaware of what was going to happen to them and made no attempt to leave. large numbers, most Eastern European Jews just stayed where they were. They didn't think that the Germans would come in and kill them. It wasn't because of a lack of immigration policy. It could say that maybe a few thousand more might have been saved or something. There also is that absolutely horrendous lie by Stephen Jay Gould in his The Mismeasure of Man, that because of the Immigration Reform Act in the 1920s, 6 million Jews were killed. I cannot believe that anyone in his right mind could say anything like that. That's insane. I mean, there's like no relation between the two. I mean, I suppose you could find some very slight correlation, you know, here or there, or the particular individual or something like that. But the unwillingness to bend immigration rules, or they weren't that unwilling because some people were allowed to escape, but the United States was going through a depression at the time, and there was a reluctance to let more people in who claimed to be refugees. Also, it was not clear that the Nazis would kill Jews at the time, right? It's like, they were just sort of stripped of certain citizenship rights. You can't say that, you know, the people who were doing this were planning to kill people against them. We were planning to kill millions of Jews or Poles or other people. There is absolutely nothing to suggest that's the case. However we decide this matter, I have no idea how this can lead to believing that we should let everybody come in from Latin America. I mean, even if all these things were true, I cannot see why we're supposed to. I would suppose this is an act of penance, you know, just let the country be flooded.
Another example, I think Huckabee, around the time he was running for president, said that giving amnesty would be a way for America to make amends for the sins of, like, slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he sounds very much like a guilt-ridden Southern white. I mean, of a type that one encounters with increasing regularity these days. I've heard a number of statements by him that that sound equally kooky.
So, before the end of the show, is there anything else of significance on cultural Marxism that you'd like to add?
Well, this is an observation that I made when I gave my address in Sweden. In comparison to the high intelligence and the openness to debate that I found in my professor, Herbert Marcuse, who was one of the architects of the Frankfurt School, the academics that I spent my last two decades with seemed like totalitarian maniacs. And every time I turn on TV and hear some politician talking, I know that I'm encountering, a journalist, I know that I'm encountering a much more intolerant mind than any that I found among representatives of the Frankfurt School. And I did meet more than one of them. And I remember I was also the editor for many years of Telos magazine, which had its origin in the Frankfurt School. And I found those people quite tolerant. Although they claim to be cultural Marxists, or whatever they call themselves, critical theorists, which is the term they prefer. But they seem certainly more tolerant than the academics whom I encountered in my work.
I'd like to thank Paul Gottfried for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.